Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Do you have student loans? If you are one of the 1 in 9 people in Massachusetts who does, relief could be on the way. Applications are open, and Massachusetts Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley wants to make sure that everyone who can apply does. Pressley represents the Massachusetts 7th Congressional District, joins us now. Congresswoman, welcome back.
Good morning, Tiziana. Good to be with you.
It's great to have you. We may have a little bit of a delay on your line, so just flagging that, we'll see how it goes. So we have a lot of serious stuff to talk about, but it's been a minute since we've spoken with you. This is a wonderful time of year, and I'm wondering, are you a fall person? Are you a Halloween person, Congresswoman?
I'm very much a fall person. Nothing like fall in New England. The foliage, the apple picking, and also the fall fashion. You know, I'm a sucker for a good boot and a scarf.
Nice. Me too. And a turtleneck. Give me a turtleneck
yes,
any day.
Turtleneck. Yeah.
And are you a costume person for Halloween?
I am not.
Yeah. I was trying to remember the last costume I wore. It was like 7 years ago. Trinity from The Matrix. Could you remember your last costume?
I cannot, honestly. when it was still okay for our daughter to dress up for Halloween. We were Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, but
nice.
Now she's 14, and so, you know, that's very uncool right now.
That's
so
right.
no family joint costume, so,
but I'm digging, digging the Ninja Turtle, and I'm a big fan of the boots and wearing boots, and today, actually, so way to go. All right, so. It was fun. We do have serious stuff to talk about. We're going
to
start.
Let's get to it.
That's right. We're going to start with student loans. I just want to do a snapshot of the numbers here of qualifiers in Massachusetts. It's interesting. This is from Department of Education in September. More than 800,000 borrowers eligible for some kind of forgiveness. More than 300,000, 344,000 of those eligible potentially to have all their student debt canceled. I'm sure you knew those numbers as you were advocating. Are you satisfied with those numbers?
Tiziana, more than the numbers, I knew the people and the stories behind the numbers, which is why over the course of the last 2 years, we have fought so hard for this transformative, meaningful relief. And I commend the Biden-Harris administration for being responsive to the needs of those burdened by this debt, a nearly $2 trillion crisis. That's right. There are 800,000 plus people eligible in the Commonwealth. And in my district, the Massachusetts 7th, over 100,000 people. We're talking about grandmothers, you know, still paying off student loans while on Social Security and a fixed income. Some who have even had their benefits garnished. You know, new parents struggling to manage the cost of childcare, rent, and student loan payments. Teachers who fear losing their licensure to teach because they've gone into default in the past. And they took on this debt because they wanted to teach our babies and set them on the best path. And of course, this is not only an economic justice issue, it's a gender justice issue. Two-thirds of this debt is disproportionately on the shoulders of women. And it's a racial justice issue due to the fact that Black and Brown communities have been unable, due to policy, policies like redlining or federal relief programs we've previously been locked out of, like the Homestead Act, the GI Bill, the New Deal, to build generational wealth. Although there's been gains in income, we don't have the wealth. And so the fact that 1 in 4 Black borrowers will have their debt zeroed out completely, that 1 in 4 Hispanic or Latinx borrowers, that half of those will have their debt canceled. This is huge.
I want to stay on that piece to understand that. So a family, so the income threshold's $125,000 for an individual, $250,000 for a family, $10,000 of debt relief. But if you have a Pell Grant, $20,000 in debt relief.
That's correct.
Right.
And we know that our Pell Grant recipients are our students, our borrowers with the greatest need. And that's exactly why we see such a huge response here. 8 million people in 48 hours have signed up by the time the website officially launched on Monday.
So two follows on that, Congresswoman. We're speaking with Massachusetts Congresswoman Anna Pressley. In that 20K range, and that's the 344,000 let me backtrack. In the 20K range, is that because people borrowed lower amounts and they're quickly eligible to have the full 20 eliminated? Or is it because the bulk of them have been paying for so long that there's 20 or less left? Do you understand what I'm trying to get at?
I think so. And that's exactly why we fought so hard for this, because yes, people have been paying on this. Most of them have been unable even to touch the principal. They're okay. Just barely, barely at the interest. And, Tiziana, we were successful in getting three payment pauses on student loan student loans during the pandemic. And that really strengthened our hand in these negotiations. We heard from people, they were able to remain safely housed. Many became first generation homeowners. And so we said, look, if this is what's happened just over the course of 2 years, imagine what would happen with this transformative action. And so those are the stories I'm already beginning to hear from people. And as I said, 8 million people by the time this site launched on Monday had already signed up. And that number in the last 48 hours has actually risen to over 12 million people. So it's really a testament to the need, how meaningful this relief is, how desperately people needed it. Student debt cancellation is going to change lives. It's going to save lives. Tiziana, I had educators who spoke with me candidly about even suicide ideation. Wow. Because they have been burdened in every way by this debt. It's taken a psychological toll. There's shame people have carried. And that's why I don't call it forgiveness. There's no shame. Borrowers are doing what we told them to do. In a meritocracy, education's the equalizer. The only problem is that we've put education farther and further out of reach when the cost has increased by 150%. And so this debt is burdensome. And we're urging folks to sign up now. Visit studentaid.gov/debt relief today. The website is available in English and Spanish. It only takes a couple of minutes to sign up. You just need your name, date of birth, social security number, and contact info.
So 12 million people as of today, 8 million on Monday. But you and Senator Elizabeth Warren don't want to leave anything to chance. You want to make sure that everybody in the Commonwealth who could benefit from this does. What are you hoping to do when you hit the road on the tour to increase enrollment?
Well, Senator Warren and I have been steadfast partners on the front lines of this fight from the very beginning. We've been pushing for student debt cancellation for years alongside our colleagues, grassroots organizers, borrowers, union families, civil rights organizations. And so, now that President Biden has canceled student debt, now we want to be just as exhaustive in using every tool available as we did to get it across the finish line to make sure that everyone who's eligible is benefiting from this meaningful relief. So we were intentional in our advocacy. Now we're going to be intentional in our outreach. We're hitting the road. And starting with the over 800,000 borrowers in Massachusetts. So it's not true if you build it, they will come, if folks don't know about it. And we know, again, just how meaningful this relief is. And we want everyone who's eligible to benefit from it. So on Tuesday, we're hitting the road to meet people right in their communities and get them signed up in real time for this life-changing, life-saving relief. So we're going to be in Boston, we'll be in Brockton, we'll be in Worcester and Springfield. And I hope that your listeners will join us, too.
So I want to just go back and flag for people. The Crisis and Mental Health Lifeline is 988. If you or someone you know is struggling with suicidal ideation, other mental health issues, the resource is 988. Congresswoman, two quick additional questions on this, because I've got a couple other things that I want to get to with you. First, one of our producers actually filled out the form this week, and before they were done, there was a warning about potential fraud. What are the concerns around fraud, and what are you doing to address that?
Thank you, Tiziana. Again, we were exhaustive and pushing for this relief to get it across the finish line. And now we're being just as exhaustive at implementation to ensure that it is efficient, that it is equitable, that it is streamlined, and that if there are any bad actors that emerge, like Navien, for example, that they are being taken into account. We do have, again, actors like Navien, who these service loan providers who have been bad actors, encouraging people to refinance. And if you do that, then you are ineligible for this relief and cancellation.
And so that's the other thing I wanted to hit, Congresswoman, to be really clear for listeners who may still be learning about this. This forgiveness, and I understand you don't like to use the word forgiveness because you've said borrowing is not wrong, but this relief is through loans, federal loans that were issued up to June 30th of 2022. So any new loan, so an incoming freshman, for example, who has a new federal loan post June 30th, does not qualify because this is a pandemic relief measure, correct?
Correct. And to your point about just fraud writ large, I'm very glad that the payment pause that we fought for on student loans, the last one is going through to December 31st. And we're glad about that because we can monitor implementation in real time so that we are made aware of any glitches, any barriers to signing up and accessing this relief for all those that are eligible. And again, if any fraud or bad actors emerge, that folks can be held accountable and that we can make people aware of that as well. I serve on the oversight committee, so I'm also wearing my oversight hat when it comes to implementation.
So I'd like to shift gears now. We had Massachusetts Congresswoman Catherine Clark on WBUR's Morning Edition this morning. She expressed optimism that with the midterm elections coming up, the Democrats will keep control of the House and the Senate. I know you're aware there's a lot of economic anxiety among voters right now. Other than student loan debt, what do you see as the most pressing economic issue for your voters? And what do you want to do about it? How do you address this economic anxiety?
Well, I think we have done that. You know, look, I'm not a pundit, but I've always said that Democrats win when Democrats deliver. So for folks who have, angst about the midterms and our chances to remain in the majority, again, Democrats win when we deliver, when people can tangibly feel the impact of our policies and our advocacy on their behalf. And so Democrats and the Biden-Harris administration, we've delivered meaningful relief in the form of the American Rescue Plan, the Inflation Reduction Act, and student debt cancellation and more.
And there's more that you feel, around gas prices or inflation.
There's always more. I mean, I want to advance policies that go as far and as deep as the herd. I want, writ large, the people that I represent to be unburdened, to not know hardship. And if they do experience it, to be able to recover quickly. But we have found ourselves in an unprecedented time as a commonwealth and a country. And that requires unprecedented leadership and legislating some things which you already have done and I've enumerated, unprecedented investment. And it's also going to require some unprecedented patience as we begin to come out of the impacts of inflation, having passed the Inflation Reduction Act and that pinch, the economic stress that people are experiencing. And while we're still doing the work of having a robust and equitable recovery from this pandemic-induced recession to ensure we leave no worker, no family, no community behind. And also, there's more work to be done to stabilize those other costs. I mean, we made strides in reducing the cost of prescription drugs through the Inflation Reduction Act. But Tiziana, I'm not giving up the fight for universal childcare and pre-K or paid leave or home and community-based services for the disabled and the elderly, or fighting for the robust investments that we need in housing to make that more affordable and accessible to folks.
So one other policy issue, we're going to run low on time. There is one other thing I want to touch bases with you on. We have been doing a multi-part series here on Radio Boston, Congresswoman, on equity in the cannabis industry in Massachusetts. And partway through that, here this happened.
President Biden pardoning thousands of people convicted of marijuana possession and ordering a review of federal pot laws. The pardon's applying to federal offenders and anyone convicted in D.C., but the president has also called on governors across the country to do the same.
I know you're aware that Governor Baker said not necessary to do it because of an expungement law that was passed in 2018. What is the most important next step in the Commonwealth on this issue in your mind?
Well, again, when President Biden took this action, he called on all of our governors to follow suit. And so Governor Baker certainly has executive authority to pardon cannabis convictions at the state level. I hope that he will give that strong consideration. But if he does not, you know, again, I'm working hard to ensure that Maura Healey is elected to the coroner office, and she's made it clear that she will take that up. And then also there are broader issues that I continue to navigate and to work on. We have a complex process here in Massachusetts that doesn't work for the overwhelming majority of people who need it. Advocates tell me that there are tens of thousands of people that qualify for expungement. So I think, you know, pardons by the governor, that's the quickest and most efficient way to bring folks relief. That's going to help folks in Massachusetts be able to overcome discrimination and barriers to secure housing and employment, and address those other things that stop them from successfully reintegrating into society. A pardon is life-changing. Governor Baker has already, you know, approved that, and it has the power to transform lives, and he should use it. We saw Baker use that authority to commute the sentences of Thomas Kuntz, William Allen, something my office and I worked closely with others in advocating for. And so I think he should meet the moment and continue to use his clemency power, including pardoning past marijuana offenses. Tiziana, last thing I do want to say, Roe, abortion care, health care is also on the ballot, and we know that's motivating people to the polls as well. So right. I think our chances are good for the midterms.
Massachusetts Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley, who represents the 7th Congressional District, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Been sneezing? God bless you. Salute. Lots of coughing, itching, eyes, maybe even trouble breathing lately. You are not alone. We are in the thick of fall allergy season. And according to experts like Kenneth Mendez, who's the president and chief executive of the Asthma and Allergy Foundation of America, it's a particularly intense season. And to add insult to injury, these allergy symptoms can be really hard to tell apart from COVID. Well, grab a box of tissues, have a seat, because for this edition of Be Well, we are diving into seasonal allergies. We're joined by Dr. Frederick Litterl, who's an allergist and immunology specialist at Boston Medical Center and a clinical associate professor of medicine at Boston University, and Sandy Hurwich, a nationally certified school nurse who has worked for Boston's public schools for 2 decades. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you
very much.
Are you both hearing me okay in your headphones?
Yes,
all right.
Good.
Excellent. So, Frederick, I'm going to start with you. We realized as we were talking this morning, we know that many people have allergies, but how does an allergy actually work? What is an allergy?
So that's a great question. Allergies start in people that are susceptible to getting allergies because it's a part of the immune system that has a function, but it's kind of dysregulated. So, of course, nobody ever had any harm from breathing in some ragweed or tree pollen or dust mites, for example. But our immune system in people that have allergies, like myself and many other people, about 20% of the American population have it. It's sort of a dysregulated immune response that sees something that should normally be harmless as harmful. And that generates a very particular type of immune response that leads to allergy symptoms.
Okay, so two things. Your body's like, uh-oh, that's bad. Protect.
And it shouldn't be doing that, but it is.
Okay, and I have to tell you, I'm amazed that it's only 20%. It seems like everybody has allergies.
That's true. I think a lot of that is because they're so prevalent. I mean, 20% or 25% of the population having a disorder is pretty high overall, if you think about it. But actually, those rates, you'll be interested to know, are increasing in the last 20, 30 years, and the cause for that isn't completely clear. But the rate of allergies, if you looked in 1980 in national health surveys to environmental allergens, like we're talking about today, have actually increased from around 8 to 10% prevalence to much more, which has led to this so-called allergy epidemic that we've heard about.
Yeah, that's more than double. That is striking. Sandy Hurwich, I'll turn to you. This is the other core question that came up for us. Can people grow into and out of allergies through throughout their lives?
I have seen allergies start in young children, you know, preschool age. And I myself had allergies as a child, grew out of them, and now in my older grown-up years, I'm feeling more allergy, seasonal allergy symptoms. And okay. I think that it goes with how your immune system, and the doctor would be able to speak better to that, that when you're very young, your immune system isn't as strong. And when you get older, your immune system response wanes a little bit. So, you know, the key years that you're feeling the maximum, you know, over response from your immune system are, you know, I would say middle childhood through, you know, early middle adulthood.
So Frederick, when I was a kid, 50 allergies at least, asthma, eczema, got better as I went along. My husband, impervious when he was younger, about 10 years ago, terrible allergies and asthma develops, right? So what's going on there?
So allergies in general, which are a risk factor not just for hay fever symptoms, but also for allergic asthma, are more prevalent in kids. And as Sandy mentioned, many people can outgrow their allergies and asthma. But we also see pretty significant rates of people who can develop adult onset allergies, even though they weren't affected as a kid. One of that can be sort of bad luck with sort of changes in the environment and the immune system, maybe moving from one region of the country to the other. In our patient population at Boston Medical Center, which is a more underserved population, we see a lot of immigrants. And there are people who come from an area of the world like South and Central America where they are exposed to certain types of aeroallergens when they're younger. But then they come to the United States. And when they come to this region, it may take 2 or 3 years for their immune system to develop that dysregulated immune response and get sort of crescendo allergy
kind of builds
symptoms
up.
As adults, yes.
So, Sandy, back to you. We know about spring allergies. We're in fall allergies. A lot of people don't know they're not the same thing. You're not guaranteed if you have spring allergies to also have fall allergies. What's the difference and what's happening for people who are having allergies now?
Well, the main culprits in the fall are ragweed pollen. So it is a pollen.
Where does it come from?
It comes from a plant that has sort of, it's green. You'll see it sometimes along the side of highways, green ragged leaves and sort of greenish looking flowers. Mm-hmm. And when those flowers release their pollen, which is usually, you know, sort of mid, late August around here, and it's active until the first frost generally, and for us, usually around November. So that is one culprit, and that gives what people refer to as hay fever symptoms, the runny nose, the itchy eyes, like all of the sort of allergy symptoms, nasal congestion, if not just the runny, thin mucus that comes out of the nose, sometimes even fatigue. You can be sneezing. You can have hives on the skin.
Yeah, yeah. And the fatigue surprises me, and
yeah.
I noticed, Frederick, that you nodded at that. And again, that surprises me. And you know, for those of you out there thinking, okay, but how is that not COVID? We're going to get to that in just a minute. I was surprised by the fatigue.
Yeah, so fatigue, I think that can happen when people have allergies and they're just, you know, worn out. Sandy and I were talking a little bit before the segment, and particularly in children, kids who have really bad allergies, and have to concentrate in school all the time can be quite tired. They may not sleep as well because their nose is stuffed, may not be able to pay attention in school so much. And so fatigue, I think, is sort of just if somebody has really uncontrolled allergies and
it just wears you out.
And I think with medication and treatment, we can make that better. But it can wear you out. But to your point, and you'll get to it later, that's different than the fatigue that we might have in differentiating allergies from COVID.
So, Sandy, staying with mm-hmm. kids and the fatigue for just a minute, you've been in the Boston Public Schools for a very long time.
Yeah.
Do you see other things that disproportionately present in kids with fall allergies or seasonal allergies than we might see elsewhere, whether it's because of their bodies or because school puts different demands on them, et cetera?
Definitely the issue with concentration in class, you know, if your eyes are watering, and I've seen kids coming in that just are tearing drips, drips, drips down their cheeks because their eyes are so irritated and sometimes puffy and swollen. Their head feels full. They feel like You know, they're having what might be described as a sinus headache, just in the front, across the forehead, across the cheeks, and that just leads them to want to put their head down, and they don't want to pay attention. Or they come to the nurse, can I lie down? I have a headache, you know, that type of thing. The coughing, I see that a lot, and sometimes it's of concern to teachers because they're not sure if Johnny, who has asthma as well, is having an asthma episode or just what's going on. And the cough is often from post-nasal drip, but that, you know, from the excess mucus in the nose and so on. That's going to take me off your question a little bit, just to mention that the allergies, to reinforce what was already said, that they can exacerbate, can cause a flare-up of atopic dermatitis, eczema, rashes, and asthma episodes.
So you therefore, can see these treating, other manifestations.
Yeah, treating the allergies is really key because that can be something that kind of sets off a worsening of those other two conditions.
And by implication, if you treat the allergy in a child early, you might be able to head off an asthma attack or some eczema on the skin, hives, et cetera.
Absolutely.
All right, so we're speaking with Sandy Hurwicz, who's a registered nurse and nationally certified nurse for the Boston Public Schools, and Frederick Little, who's an allergist and immunology specialist at Boston Medical Center. Okay, I do want to get in now because we've talked about so many things, coughing and fatigue and your head feels full and you're tired and maybe you're having trouble breathing. Frederick, those, I mean, I've had COVID and I've had times before I had COVID where I thought my allergies might be COVID. Now, believe me, once I had COVID, I do not get the things confused anymore. But for the lucky people who maybe are allergy sufferers who haven't had COVID, how do we know the difference other than a test?
I can't tell you how many home antigen tests my wife has burned through having a little bit of a scratchy throat. And in fact, she doesn't have very bad allergies, but has a little bit of them. So there are a lot of overlap in symptoms, especially with the newer strains that we're seeing, where a lot of nasal congestions, it feels a bit more like a cold, scratchy throat, a little bit of cough, not so much involvement of the eyes, but there can be a lot of overlap, especially as we come into the season. The things that differentiate COVID from allergies are, first of all, fever is an unusual complication of people having regular seasonal allergies, even if they're significantly affected by that.
So you rarely would see a fever in
allergies. You wouldn't expect a fever in allergies. Now, people who have very severe uncontrolled allergies and have sinusitis and, you know, much more advanced issues with allergies can have a fever if they have an infection that goes along with it, but very uncommon. So I think the learning point is that fever, along with some allergy-suspected symptoms, definitely warrants getting a COVID test. And the other thing is, as we were talking about the fatigue before, I also had COVID in April, and I wasn't necessarily short of breath. I didn't have COVID pneumonia, but I was able to go from my quarantine cell in one part of the house down to go outdoors where it was warm enough with a jacket to be outside, and I just felt exhausted. Mm-hmm. So the degree of fatigue and just feeling run down, kind of like what you might feel with a bad case of the flu, does differentiate seasonal allergies from COVID. So fever, a sense of fatigue that's out of proportion to just being a little bit run down would be the triggers that would say, okay, let's be careful, you know, stay away from older people, other people who might get infected and get a COVID test at home or with your healthcare provider.
Now, we know from years, actually, now of doing Ask the Doctors on this show, Sandy, that we're not providing tailored medical care to individuals on this show, but general advice to families about how to mitigate, slow down, catch allergies early, et cetera. What are some of the advice that you give to parents and families?
Well, I'd like to add on to what Dr. Little said about just how to differentiate between allergy and, let's say, cold symptoms or another type of infection that's going on. Itchy eyes, I think that you mentioned, Doctor, are not usually seen with a cold or an infection of some other sort, like pneumonia or whatever. And of course, fever is not usually seen with allergies. And the other thing that's interesting to me is that with a cold, symptoms will appear sometimes one at a time. Like maybe you'll get a sore throat for a day and a half, and that'll progress to sneezing. And then later on, the cough comes into play. Whereas allergy symptoms tend to appear kind of occur all at the same time. Boom. Or, you know, you get one and within a few hours, there you are. So In terms of getting back to your question, what can we do to mitigate?
Yeah.
So, well, the best thing is to avoid exposure to the allergen to begin with. So if you want to stay away from ragweed pollen, and the other culprit I didn't mention are molds in the fall. So when you have the wet leaves gathering, mold can build up in that, and, you know, just walking through the woods can be a trigger, you know, and the fun things like raking leaves with the kids and diving into the pile of leaves and that kind of thing. Not a good thing for people that are allergy sufferers at this time of year. So you want to avoid some of that outdoor stuff. When you are outside, I found, at least with the kids that I've worked with, if they're wearing eyeglasses or can put on sunglasses,
that eye protection.
That can prevent some of the pollen from eye contact and causing the inflammation there and the irritation. Also, when you come in from outdoors, the end of the day or after playing, a shower, shampoo the hair, never wear your outdoor clothes to bed. You know, take off the outdoor clothes as soon as you get in the house, put them aside, and just keep in mind that you're in bed, kids, 8 to 10 hours a day, and you don't want to have...
So keep that space clean.
Absolutely. In the bedroom, you don't want to have the pollen circulating, and you want to not have pollen and mold spores on your hair when you go to bed, because you'll be just breathing in and all
sitting
that
duck. Line. All right. Sandy Hurwicz is a Boston Public School nurse. Frederick Little is an allergist and immunology specialist at Boston Medical Center and a clinical associate professor of medicine at Boston University. This has been our Be Well segment. Thanks to both of you for joining us.
Thank you
for
having us.
Some salt marshes in Massachusetts are feeling a little under the weather these days, so they're getting a little muscle to bring them back to health. We take a look at this experiment in this week's From the Newsroom. WBUR environmental reporter Barbara Moran joins us to share more about the project and her reporting on it. Barbara, welcome back.
Hello. Happy to be here.
Well, muscle. We're talking about ribbed mussels and salt marshes, right?
That is correct.
All right, so let's break some things down.
Absolutely. Okay, do you want me to start with some basics about salt marshes?
I do.
Okay, so everybody's on the same page. So a salt marsh is a wetland that's on the coast, and they're called salt marshes because salt water comes in and out of them with the tides, right? And there are about 45,000 acres of these on the Massachusetts coast, which sounds like a lot, but we've lost about 41% of them since the 1700s.
Okay, so nearly half.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
And when they're working, we like them because ...
They do everything. They're so amazing. So they filter water, they buffer storm surge, they protect from storms, they absorb pollutants, they give a lot of habitat for birds and little baby lobsters and all kinds of things. So they are really super useful. Oh, and they sequester a ton of carbon, too. So they're amazing in so many ways.
Yeah. So but they can get unhealthy.
They can.
So talk about that.
Okay. So salt marshes can get unhealthy in various ways. And I visited one. So when they get unhealthy, they can look in different ways. So I visited one that was really unhealthy up in Newburyport, and it was really eroded. Like when you're walking through it, there's all these sinkholes. So I have a little bit of sound of me walking through it and looking at these. Oh my God, this is so eroded.
Isn't it?
Oh, it's terrible.
You don't see it when you're up.
Wow.
And so, this is not just happening on our property. This is happening along this entire shoreline.
So it was just like these huge craters and sinkholes like opening up. And it just looked so sad.
So, and you were talking there with Mass Audubon ecologist Annalee Tweetman.
Yes.
Yeah, but that's not the only place. And this is a good chance to bring in our other voice here. So Nancy Powell is a wildlife biologist at the North Shore's Parker River National Wildlife Refuge, also here in Studio 2. Welcome, Nancy.
Thank you, Tatiana. Nice to be here.
So what we were just hearing, Barbara, is like, oh my gosh, this is so eroded. Does that sound familiar?
It is. We are seeing a lot of areas where the marshes are getting wetter and eroded, but we also have a lot of other parts of the marsh that are quite healthy, and it's good to focus on those and work on those to keep them healthy as well.
So why are the ones that are healthy, healthy, and the ones that are sick, sick?
It's a whole spectrum. So where a salt marsh is, And the tides that flood them affects it. So the marsh that Barbara visited is along the Merrimack River, and it's a very narrow fringe marsh. So there's not a lot of room, and the waves are hitting it. Big waves are hitting it. The marshes that's at the Parker River National Wildlife Refuge and in the Gray Marsh is actually behind a big dune and beach area. So it's more protected. It's also quite a bit larger. It's, you know, some areas are 2 to 3 miles across. So if you think about it, when the waves hit, the marsh actually does its job. It slows that wave down. It dissipates it before it hits those houses behind those marshes. And that's what we want a healthy marsh to do.
To be able to do. So this is our From the Newsroom segment on salt marshes and mussels. We've got Nancy Powell, who's a wildlife biologist at North Shore's Parker River National Wildlife Refuge here, as well as WBUR environmental reporter Barbara Moran. So now we introduce a little mussel in here in the form of mussels. So talk about that, Barbara.
So I reported on a story today about a new pilot program using ribbed mussels to help heal a very eroded salt marsh. So I had never heard of ribbed mussels. I've heard of blue mussels, which you've probably seen before and eaten, right? So much like blue mussels, these ribbed mussels produce these Bissell threads, then that helps them cling into place and protect themselves. And it also turns out that holds marshes together, right? So here is Mass Audubon ecologist Annalee Twightman again talking about that.
So some people actually call ribbed mussels habitat engineers because through the production of these Bissell threads, by attaching to the roots, they are causing this chunk of peat to stay together. So that's the number one reason why we think they could be really great in a restoration project, is they can really stabilize a very unstable salt marsh.
And so they live in salt marshes. Like, I guess I always thought mussels just lived in the ocean, right? But these mussels live in the mud in salt marshes. And I went with Twightman to go look for them. And we're looking around and she's like, oh, they're all over the place. And I'm like, it just looks like mud. I don't see anything. So here's another cut where she found them.
Here, we can start to see some rib mussels. I know it's hard to see, but most of their bodies are covered in this mud. They're stuck in the peat. So here we see one little ribbed mussel.
Oh my God, I can't even see it. Right? It's all buried in there.
It's hard to imagine, like, that's a filter feeder. There's barely anything exposed.
So what she was doing was collecting these mussels from the healthy marsh, and she's going to put them in the unhealthy marsh and see if they can take in there. And if they can survive in the unhealthy marsh, then she's hoping that they will help hold that unhealthy marsh together too.
So it raises two questions, and I'm just going to unabashedly, Nancy, ask them, even if I might sound a little silly for not knowing. Okay. First, what is a filter feeder? And second, what exactly is peat?
Oh, okay, I have to clarify that I am not a mussel biologist, so I'm going to try my best here. A filter feeder is any animal that takes their food by sucking in water. They filter out the food, which is typically plants or animals that we can't even see. They're microscopic. Mm-hmm. And then they put the water back out. So a lot of our clams, our mussels, our bivalves, our filter feeders.
They literally clean the water and put it back out there.
Exactly. And that's why they're so good. So a lot of them also clean pollutants because they take that in and they put the clean water back out. And peat is basically mud and undecomposed vegetation. Mm-hmm. Peat is what makes salt marshes such a good carbon sequester. So Barbara had talked about how it's really good at taking that carbon out of the air, and instead of decomposing and releasing that carbon back into the air, it actually buries it. So mud gets on top and it creates peat, and that's how salt marshes grow. And it's how it's going to be able to keep up with sea level rise.
So you literally get things like dead grass and weeds, and just like the allergist was talking about, all those leaves in the fall that, you know.
Yeah.
So those get down in the mud. The mud clumps them all up. You get this goopy, veggie stuff. And then, Barbara, the pictures on this. In fact, I pulled one up right here so that I can kind of describe it as we're talking.
Yeah.
So then these mussels, and they're little, right? Maybe the size of your palm.
Yeah, like, you know, mussel size.
Yeah.
Blue mussel size.
You
say, right?
I have small mussels. I'm just saying. It's maybe the size of your palm. They have these little threads that you talked about, but I want people, it's like watching tiny little silk spider web threads.
Yep, yep.
And they stick them on each other and other things, and it forms this bolus that holds this mud ball together.
Yeah.
Am I right?
That's pretty much right. And the threads are like this super, super strong substance. It's like one of the strongest things in nature that we know of. And they all cling together to protect themselves, and it has this amazing side effect of protecting the marsh.
So how will we know if this experiment of picking them up and putting them somewhere else works?
Well, she's going to go back in the spring, the ecologist, and see if they survived. And this is a pilot project. You know, there are, in this very, you know, degraded marsh, right now there are no mussels. And she's not sure why. She's not sure if they all died or if there's just not enough food for them or whatever. So she's going to see if this first batch can survive the winter. And if they do, then she's going to scale it up into a bigger project. That's the plan.
So we're talking about salt marshes, an effort to save salt marshes, the damage that's happening to salt marshes here in the area. This is our From the Newsroom segment with WBUR environmental reporter Barbara Moran and with Nancy Powell, who is a wildlife biologist at the North Shores Parker River National Wildlife Refuge. So now, Nancy, I want to get serious. We've been having a lot of fun with this, and scientifically, it's really fascinating. But this is also a really big deal. What is the loss to humans if we don't wind up protecting what remains of our salt marshes?
Well, Barbara already talked about what salt marshes do for us in terms of protecting them from storms, protecting, you know, the homes and the carbon sequestration. I think, you know, for a lot of us that live near the marsh and live near the ocean, salt marsh is also the fabric of our community, right? Mm. If we think about the landscape and what we drive by, you know, we fish in the marsh, we kayak in the marsh. There's, you know, the food that we eat comes from the marsh. Everybody loves steamers, you know, that comes from the marsh. So we are losing not just what the marshes support in terms of wildlife and but also the cultural resource, the cultural aspects of our community that is so tied to the marsh.
And can we keep up, Nancy? Can we keep up with what's happening to, you know, Barbara, you said we've lost more than 40% since the 1700s.
Yeah, yeah.
Can we keep up with the rate of damage to our local salt marshes? Do we know how to do that?
Well, luckily for us, nature is actually quite resilient. And as I mentioned, Barbara visited one marsh that is in really bad shape, but that is probably some of the worst portions. There's still a lot of marshes that's quite healthy. And there is a large partnership all over Massachusetts. I work in the North Shore in the Gray Marsh, but there's a lot of organizations that are working to keep those marshes healthy. And we've now learn how to do that.
And besides mussels, how do you do that?
So what we have learned is that historically, when the Europeans first colonized the area, they actually heavily relied on salt marshes, and they cut hay from the marshes for a lot of uses. What we have now learned is that in order to increase production, they've put ditches and berms or dikes in the marshes. And those same ditches on burns are still having an impact in the marsh's ability to keep up with sea level rise. So we've now been testing a bunch of different techniques to figure out how to get the marsh healthy and allow it to do its job, which is to keep up with sea level rise. And we feel really good about these techniques, and we've been putting them together and scaling them up. And I think we're poised to be able to do that in the next couple of years.
So Barbara Moran, I'll turn back to you now. You know, you've done a range of reporting over the years on how we mitigate climate change and also these little magnificent species that we find different places. You've done coral, you've done mussels. In pursuing this story, what struck you the most about it? What captured you the most?
Well, I think it's just, you know, Nancy and I were talking earlier about how resilient nature is if we just sort of like maybe not mess with it so much, right? And I think this is a case with the marshes. And I think Nancy's just done some great work in sort of looking at how the marshes behave and understanding them and working to fix them. And I just think, you know, the mussels are just like, you're just like, oh, I don't know, like, oh, this little thing does so much. And if we just give it a little bit of help, maybe it could make this big difference.
And is there anybody, by the way, Barbara, I didn't think to ask you this when we were preparing. Is there anybody pushing back saying you shouldn't move mussels from like one salt marsh to another?
No, because it's the same ecosystem. You're not moving them. They're not like, you know, invaders or foreign or anything like that. So it's, yeah, they're just a couple miles down the road. Yeah.
So what are you going to follow now on this?
Well, I'm hoping to go back in the spring and check out this little batch and see how they're doing. And hopefully they're, you know, they've survived. And if they haven't, then we'll see what else can be done to help that marsh.
And Nancy Powell. So I would say that a week ago, salt marshes and ribbed mussels were not on my radar screen as important. What's the next thing that we're all going to be surprised about, or a thing that you're paying attention to that we should too?
So one of the kind of canaries of the marsh that we are very focused on is a bird called the salt marsh sparrow. And this bird only lives in salt marshes and only in the United States, which is pretty rare. And there's not that many of them left. And as the marshes flood, they're going to be in trouble because their nests will flood out. So part of the work that we're doing is to slow that decline and allow them to be able to rebound. And so we're watching that bird very closely as we restore these marshes and hope that we can save that special species.
All right. Nancy Powell is a wildlife biologist at the North Shore's Parker River National Wildlife Refuge. Barbara Moran is WBUR environmental reporter. Thanks so much to both of you. That was really fun.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
So it's official. In a ceremonial signing at the Museum of Science in Boston earlier today, Governor Charlie Baker commemorated the naming of an official state dinosaur. Ready for this? Podokosaurus holyokensis. Loosely translated, it means swift-footed lizard. Wait. From Holyoke. The effort to name a state dinosaur started with a contest from State Representative Jack Lewis. He created the contest to help kids get interested in the legislative process, but it really blew up. According to MassLive, by February of 2021, more than 35,000 people had cast a ballot on this. Now, according to the Smithsonian Magazine and the Natural History Museum, the species was, it was carnivorous, 3 to 6 feet long, lived about 195 to 180 million years ago, and it was discovered in 1910 near Mount Holyoke by Minyon Talbot, the first woman to name and describe a dinosaur. We have had a blast following this, thinking about nicknames, Pokey, Dokey, none of it works, but we will think of one. And in the meantime, congratulations to Podokosaurus holyokensis. We're glad to make it official. And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.